Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadalska. On today's show, we check in with both political parties on how they're hoping to get young voters more involved.
The younger generation is ready for something different, whether it's conservative or progressive.
Have you ever wondered who's behind the voice that reads all the bills in the Wyoming legislature? We'll hear from the Senate reading clerk about his job and his voice.
One of my best friends on the Senate session staff just gives me constant heartache about people tuning in because I'm talking.
We'll learn about a group of Black musicians that left a lasting musical influence on Buffalo Bill's Wild West show.
They were a band. They were a ragtime band. They were 18 players strong.
Those stories and more coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News.
This time on The Modern West, we climb the Grand Teton exactly 100 years to the day after Eleanor Davis became the first recorded woman to ever climb it.
I really do believe courage is like a muscle.
And we do it with a bunch of women. Courage is a muscle. It's part one of our new series, High Altitude Tales. Find it under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Sponsored by the Wyoming Women's Foundation.
Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Camila Kadalska. Democrats and Republicans in Washington are looking for new ways to attract young voters. But what about the parties here in Wyoming? Wyoming Public Radio's Jordan Uplinker reports.
You know, everyone introducing themselves. I just wanted to say thank you all so much for being here.
Emma Jones is speaking in the family room at the University of Wyoming to a room full of students. Jones is the co-founder of College Dems, a new political group on campus.
It's really important to have, especially young people like college students, engaged in their political processes, especially at the local level.
This room is the same place that a much more conservative group, Turning Point USA, hosted the Wyoming Freedom Caucus a few months ago. At the right-wing event, they were talking about issues close to the hearts of conservatives, like reining in state spending, protecting private property owners from federal encroachment, advocating for Trump, and supporting parental control in education. Today, though, the College Democrats have policy goals centered around keeping Trump out of office. Here's UW student and state committee woman Artemis Langford.
We believe that everyone should have a right to health care. Everyone deserves to have control over their own body. We believe that, you know, climate change is not only real, but it's having considerable impact on our planet.
And the hope is that these are the issues that could turn out the Wyoming youth vote. College Dems, Emma Jones again.
Like, young people have been engaging in politics more and more. People recognize now more than ever that their, like, vote matters, and that not just national politics, but local politics.
Research has shown elections to be increasingly focused on the presidential race, leaving the down-ballot candidates to adopt standard party policy. That leaves state lawmakers in a unique position to listen and respond directly to young voters, like Carly Provenza, a Democratic representative in Laramie. She's gone so far as to create a position on her staff focused exclusively on keeping up with social media trends and young voters' issues of interest.
I don't know any other members that have a youth mentor, but I do. So making sure that I'm also keeping in line with what do young people want.
Then there's Daniel Singh, a Republican representative from Cheyenne. Even though he's across the aisle from Provenza, he also cares deeply about the opinions of Wyoming youth.
I'm the second youngest member of the legislature in the state of Wyoming. I'm also a member of Run Gen Z, which is a group of state legislators from across the country who are in Generation Z and are conservatives.
Both Provenza and Singh are young members in their state parties. They don't agree on much, but like younger voters everywhere, Provenza and Singh also don't see eye to eye with their traditional party platforms either.
There is that shift on the National Democrat side, right? They're more traditional Democrats, and younger people tend to be progressive. And then on the other side, they're more traditional conservatives, right? The old guard, and the younger conservatives tend to be more libertarian, I would say.
Singh admits that some of his conservative views differ greatly from older members in his party. For instance, his opinions on how the right talks about cannabis usage. Provenza also tries to focus on policy over party. She's under no illusions of a youth-led blue wave hitting Wyoming. In fact, she concedes that most students and young people in Wyoming are generally conservative in their politics.
But I also know that the younger generation is ready for something different. Whether it's conservative or progressive, they're ready for something different.
Recently, young activists amassed at least 50 people outside the state capitol in Cheyenne to protest continued U.S. weapons sales to Israel. Youth activists are making their voices heard. However, the youth are not a unified and organized political party. The differences between those voters and between Provenza and Singh can be heard in the political appeal they make to young people, which for Singh sounds like this.
When political parties try to pitch things to young people, they talk down to young people. But the issues that we're dealing with today, these are the questions of how involved should the government be in your life? Should the government be able to take money from you? Do you have sovereignty over your property?
By contrast, here's Provenza's pitch to Democratic youth voters.
We talked about childcare. We talked about pre-K. We talked about reproductive healthcare choices. Those are things that young people need when they think about, are they going to have a family? And how are they going to even raise a family if we don't have any policies in place that support them in doing so?
While Provenza and Singh have very different policy priorities, their method to achieving them is surprisingly similar. Get more young people on board with your party and get them voting. Singh wants young people to stay in Wyoming and commit to an agenda.
Join your party. Become a precinct person. And from there, you build the relationships within your community to actually have those conversations with people that you know in order to further whatever goal that it is you have for your community.
It might not be much in the way of bipartisanship, but for young voters, the message is clear. The parties can't grow or change without youth. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Jordan Uplinger.
Now, a story that pulls the curtain on the Wyoming legislature. If you tune in to a live stream or sit in the gallery of the Wyoming Senate, odds are you'll hear the dulcet voice of Randy Fetzer reading out bill descriptions to throngs of seated legislators. Wyoming Public Radio's Chris Clements found out more about the person behind that voice.
It looks very funny for me to see the desk cleared.
It's been about a month since this year's legislative budget session ended. But Randy Fetzer settles back into his seat at the front of the Senate chambers like it's still underway.
And this is my view of the glass. It's just spectacular.
As the Senate reading clerk, he's in the spotlight while reading out bills to dozens of Wyoming's most powerful political figures.
Endurance gets really challenging. When the days get long, the chair gets really, really uncomfortable. And for those of us here, especially the assistant chief clerk and for me, we can't get up and move around at all during the time that we're gaveled in.
But Fetzer's job is purely as support staff, not as a decision maker. He keeps his thoughts and opinions about ongoing proceedings to himself. As a reading clerk, he reads every bill number, title, sponsor, and enacting clause for legislation that passes through the Senate, often several times. Here's just a taste.
February 16, 2024, Mr. President's Committee Number 4, Education, to whom is referred Senate File 19, Developmental Preschool Funding, respectfully reports same back to the Senate with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Biteman, Brennan, Rothfuss, Scott, and Steinmetz, Senator Scott, Chairman.
For the last 9 years, Fetzer has worked part-time as a reading clerk in Cheyenne. As he can attest, clerks must adapt to fast-paced, constantly changing circumstances. He's often handed a bill jacket relating to subjects like carbon capture or abortion regulations, or even a letter from Governor Mark Gordon.
So those are completely cold reads at that point. And I can sometimes get lost and forget which direction something's going. Yeah, it can move quickly sometimes.
Then he's got to fire off the information to lawmakers with expeditious speed while remembering to enunciate clearly and use good diction. Anyone who sat in the Senate gallery and observed legislators as they debate, decry, and defend bills has almost certainly heard Fetzer's voice guiding the way.
The reading clerk, please read the bills.
Senate Day 1, Consent List B. The following seven bills are sponsored by the Judiciary Committee. Senate File 30, Influencing Jurors and Witnesses, Judges Amendment. Senate File 31, Sex Offender Registration, Promoting Obscenity. Senate File 32, Hemp Limitations on Psychoactive Substances.
Fetzer is well known around the Capitol for having a mellifluous vocal style. He was a radio host in Colorado for years. And after retiring from teaching English at Laramie County Community College, he's landed himself a gig here in the Wyoming legislature.
One of my best friends on the Senate session staff just gives me constant heartache about people tuning in because I'm talking. And I tell everybody, don't listen to what Dick says.
Fetzer says the admiration of his vocal abilities reminds him of a line from a play by Shakespeare.
It's a comedic line. One of the characters, when he misunderstands some things that are being said, looks back at the person giving him heartache and says, oh, it's the gifts God gives. But really, that's just it. It's just my voice.
The attitude Fetzer tries to keep when working around so many politicians is simple.
Do the best possible read to help the senators do their job. Try not to make a mistake.
For the rest of the year, Fetzer enjoys singing as a bass in the local choir and visiting microbreweries throughout the state. According to him, it's much more relaxing than this part-time gig, but he says he has no plans to quit anytime soon. Reporters, lawmakers, and citizens will continue to hear his voice echoing through the Senate chambers. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Chris Clements.
Housing is a growing issue across the state, and we hear about a unique solution. That's up next on Open Spaces.
My name is Conrad Smith. I grew up in Kansas, but I've lived in Laramie for 18 years now. I think that the primary function of public radio, at least in my opinion, is news and keeping public officials accountable. The entertainment is available many other places, but good quality news is not widely available, and I do believe Wyoming Public Radio has the best broadcast news in the United States right now. The service public radio provides is worth paying for, I guess, quite simply. Anybody who listens a lot has kind of a moral obligation to help pay the bills.
Begin or renew your membership on our secure website, wyomingpublicmedia.org. Click on the Pledge Now link. Thanks for your support.
Wyoming Public Radio now takes you around Wyoming. You'll hear about interesting stories and events from just down the street and around the state. Around Wyoming, weekday mornings at 6:06 and 8:06, and afternoons at 1:04 and 4:50. You can also subscribe to our daily roundup newsletter at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. Teton County has seen a boom in construction in recent years, with old homes demolished and mansions built in their place. But what happens to the old structures? Jackson Hole Community Radio Station's Emily Cohen reports on an organization that is trying to repurpose them to address the region's worsening housing crisis.
It's all original. Obviously, the walls are new since they took it down.
In a quiet neighborhood in Etna, Wyoming, Sarah Shervin and her husband Mitch walk around their new home. It's bright and open with big windows and filled with antiques.
This is a Singer sewing machine that belonged to Mitch's grandmother, and she was born in Pinedale, I want to say 1936, I believe.
Sarah and Mitch's families have been in the region for decades. Despite their roots in Teton County, the couple, both working professionals, almost had to leave. They lost their housing in East Jackson last summer and ended up camping and staying on friends' couches for several weeks while they searched for a solution.
So we had furniture and three dogs and nowhere to live. We went down to Salt Lake, looked at houses down there. We looked in Las Vegas. We didn't know what to do. We looked at condos in Jackson.
Last year, the median sale price of a single-family home in Teton County was over $3 million, and inventory was historically low, nearly the lowest in 40 years. The couple ended up getting lucky. They eventually found a house in Star Valley. They now have to commute to work in Jackson, but the house was an unheard-of price in the region, just under $600,000.
So had we not have found this house, I can't say for sure we would have stayed. We probably honestly would have left.
But this isn't a typical house. The home once sat in downtown Jackson. Known as the Red House, it was originally owned by descendants of the region's early settlers. It was slated for demolition before it was picked up off its foundation and moved 50 miles south. This was all coordinated by the local organization Shacks on Racks, which also bought the land and renovated the house for a fraction of the typical price of new construction.
We turnkeyed it for about $120 a square foot. So when you're looking, you know, and that's everything new. We did a 900 square foot garage with an additional bedroom, three bathrooms, four bedrooms, brand new kitchen.
That's the organization's founder, Esther Judge Lennox, who says her group received the structure for free. And by donating the home, the original owners also saved tens of thousands of dollars in demolition fees. The Red House was one of 26 homes that Shacks on Racks has moved since it started in 2015. What is one person's trash is another person's treasure. In the organization's time, Judge Lennox estimates it has saved 10% of the inventory of homes slated for demolition in Teton County.
I mean, I'm all about reduce, reuse, recycle, but that was not the intention when I started this. It hasn't been until we've moved 26 homes that we've realized that we've kept, you know, over 1.5 million pounds of trash out of the trash.
But even if you can get a house for free through Shacks on Racks, finding a place to put it is a big challenge, especially with the high cost of land in the region.
You know, we're like chasing this dragon of land ownership in Wyoming.
So whether reducing waste from the landfill or finding homes for locals, Claire Stumpf from the affordable housing nonprofit Shelter JH says anything that helps make a dent in the housing crisis is welcome.
Well, I definitely am not under the impression that there's going to be one solution that's going to solve everything. So I think people operating in the realms that matter to them, in this case for Shacks on Racks relocating homes, is one of the many solutions we'll need to pursue.
When proposals for affordable housing developments come before local officials, they often require adding density to town, something a portion of the community is opposed to. Stumpf says they're concerned about losing local character and Jackson's Western heritage. So moving existing and sometimes historic buildings could appeal to a range of people.
I feel like that's one of those very, very rare solutions that appeals to people who need access to stable housing and people who have been maybe part of the old guard, and they're very averse to seeing larger developments show up in our community.
For Sarah and Mitch Shervin, they were able to find affordable housing and have their own piece of Jackson history.
I mean, it was good financially. It was nice to buy a piece of Jackson history. It allows us to stay here, continue to work our jobs, be part of the Teton County workforce.
Housing Jackson and preserving Jackson can go hand in hand, although in some cases, it means doing so an hour from Jackson. At least, the Shervins say, they're in good company.
In this subdivision alone, there's for sure 5 households of Jacksonville High School graduates, which both Mitch and I are. I see more people down here now that I haven't seen in 20 years.
And because of this home, she says her future children will be able to have a place in Wyoming. For KHOL, I'm Emily Cohen.
Workers in Jackson Hole face unique challenges to power the community. Servers, educators, nurses, home builders, and more often have to deal with the high cost of living, long commutes, and for some, learning new languages for their jobs. In a new series of radio diaries from Jackson Hole Community Radio, we get to know more about some folks that help the community thrive and what drives them to stay there. Sylvia Davila is a Spanish language interpreter at Jackson Hole Elementary School. Recent estimates put Teton County's Latino demographic at roughly 30% of the total population.
My name is Silvia Davila Tellez.
So I started the career of interpreter and translator. I have lived in Mexico City. I was born over there, and I came over here in 1998. My sister Carmina was already working here, and she told me that this was a really great place to be in. When I was in Mexico, my father was already having economical problems, and I decided to give my kids and myself an opportunity to come over here and have them learn English. My favorite part of living in Jackson is the place. I mean, I come from huge, cosmopolitan and beautiful city, which is Mexico City. And coming over here is just the other side of the coin, just going outside, seeing the snow when you wake up and you see the sky. And I mean, we have a lovely place. I love this place. My day starts showering and then arriving to school. The first thing I do when I come here, I go to the lunchroom and I mingle with all the kids, K through fifth grade, and I just supervise. And then I come back over here to my office, and then I start looking at my email. Let me tell you, Mondays are, oh my gosh, when I open my computer and I see Monday emails, it's like, okay. I usually start translating the letters that go home to the Latino parents, and I translate them from kinder to fifth grade teachers. So I start getting this letter from this teacher, this letter from the other teacher. So in between the translations throughout the day, I get a lot of interruptions, phone calls that parents need something. Or that the teachers need me to call the parents because the kid needs this or that. So I get involved in too many things. And in one of the interpreters meeting that I just went like last week, they were asking, if you were a hero, which hero would you like to be? I said, I would love to be Flash, because then I could just do so many things. So talking about the Latino community, I think they're doing their best effort to get their kids educated. They call me a lot to find out about, you know, resources and everything. They struggle with housing, and the rents are just so high. They have to work probably 2-3 jobs. They have to work so much. Sometimes they don't have enough time. And I would love to have more time to help each grade level with resources and everything. I know teachers give 100%, 120% of their time and effort, but there's a lot more that we can do. And we need more interpreters. We need more people to be bilingual, to be able to help. But I love what I do. I love the kids. It's something that I enjoy a lot. You come over here and you get hugs from the little ones, and then they tell you about their day. And it's just amazing. So many things that you can learn from the kids. And I just love to be here.
That was Sylvia Davila, a Spanish language interpreter at Jackson Hole Elementary School. This radio diary was produced by Jackson Hole Community Radio contributor Kieran Hadley. There are more and more wind turbines going up in the state. Up next, a look at research hoping to reduce avian deaths. This is Open Spaces.
Every day, Wyoming Public Radio brings you the news, from the latest on the pandemic recovery to ongoing issues of race, climate change, energy, and the economy. Tune in for what's happening here in Wyoming, around the Mountain West, and beyond with state and regional news updates during Morning Edition, Here and Now, and All Things Considered. And you can find the latest news anytime at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Stay informed with Wyoming Public Radio.
Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Camila Kadalska. Wind energy is a big part of the transition away from fossil fuels, but that comes with consequences, including the potential for more deadly collisions between turbines and birds. Wyoming Public Radio's Will Walkie reports on an experiment underway to try and solve that problem.
We don't want to let them out quite yet because we're not ready for them. Sorry, guys.
Megan Warren is showing me around the Teton Raptor Center in Wilson. It's a compound made up of several brown and red barns at the base of the looming Tetons. In one building are avian ambassadors, including turkey vultures, owls, and golden eagles. That's Warren's personal favorite.
Their prowess, their hunting ability, their speed, their power.
The nonprofit provides research and educational programming about large birds. It's also a rehab center that takes in raptors from all over the state.
I'm going to switch to clinic shoes.
Next door, Warren and I have to keep our voices down while we watch a golden eagle get treatment on her feet larger than a baseball glove.
When we're working with wild birds, they're not used to people. And so loud voices can be really scary to them. So.
This bird came from Farson and developed a type of dermatitis. She has a hood over her head while volunteers and vets treat sores. Others may get physical therapy or even laser therapy on their joints so they can get back into flying shape before getting released back into the wild.
Over here, we have this big flight barn, and this is where the golden eagle lives. And this is about 85 feet from one end to the other. And we make them fly 20 times back and forth without a break.
Warren says golden eagles are one of the most common birds they see, and it can be for many reasons, like lead poisoning, running into buildings or cars, or one time, a collision with a wind turbine. Brian Bedrosian is also with the Raptor Center.
So we were able to rehabilitate that bird and release it. So it's not always instantaneous death, though I'd say the majority of cases, the turbine wins and the bird doesn't.
Wyoming is also a critical part of the golden eagle habitat. Tens of thousands live here, and the state is a huge migration corridor for some birds that move from Alaska to Mexico. But unlike its cousin the bald eagle, the golden eagle population is stable at best. And Bedrosian says wind energy growth is a threat.
So if they're up soaring looking for prey, they're never looking over their shoulder for something else to come get them. And so when they don't see that turbine blade going at 180 miles an hour, it could potentially hit them.
Wind turbines are nowhere near the largest threat to winged wildlife. They kill an estimated hundreds of thousands of birds and bats a year, but that's still exponentially less than things like power lines, cars, buildings, and even house cats. Still, it's new and growing, especially in the West. The largest wind farm in the continental U.S. is being built in Wyoming.
It's just another piece that wasn't there before that is affecting that kind of tipping point going towards a negative population trend.
And since golden and bald eagles have federal protections, this is an expensive problem for utilities. One wind company had to pay more than $8 million in fines in 2020 after killing at least 150 eagles over a decade. Right now, the best way to prevent collisions is to stop the turbine from spinning when birds are around. But Shiloh Felton, a scientist with the Renewable Energy Wildlife Institute, says that's inefficient.
It also results in lost energy production. And that lost energy has to be made up somewhere to meet our energy demands as people.
Enter a potential solution. One small-scale study in Norway found that painting a single blade black allowed birds to likely see the turbine better and avoid collisions. The reduction was over 70%. Researchers are now expanding that study in Glenrock. They've painted 36 turbines and will track collisions over several years to see if it makes a difference. Felton says it's an incredible opportunity.
Wildlife conservation doesn't happen in a vacuum. We have to consider how we as humans interact with wildlife and how we can address those challenges so that humans and wildlife can coexist.
This is the beginning of the research process, and there are a ton of unanswered questions. Like, do North American birds see turbines the same way as European ones? Will the general public tolerate black blades? But Jonna Whitesides, a spokesperson for the utility PacifiCorp that owns the turbines, says it's worth learning more.
Of course it's exciting because it's something new, something that's never really been tried. Now, if it is viable, it definitely could be one of those solutions that could be rolled out, you know, nationwide.
For the Teton Raptor Center, this cooperation is encouraging. My tour guide, Megan Warren, says climate change is an existential threat to global bird populations.
So we need to move away from fossil fuels. I think that's really clear. And I'm supportive of renewable energies, but I don't want to wipe out golden eagles in the process.
Ideally, researchers want to combine the results of this study with others around the world. In the meantime, if you're in central Wyoming, keep an eye out for those painted turbine blades scraping the sky. For Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Will Walkie in Wilson.
The new season of Wyoming Public Radio's podcast, The Modern West, just dropped its first episode, but the format is pretty different from how we've done things in the past. This season, we're going out in the field with some of the reporters you'll recognize from this show. The Modern West host and producer, Melody Edwards, is here to talk through the decision to try something new this time around. Thanks for being here, Melody.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So tell me about the very different format of this season of the podcast, and why are we breaking the mold?
You know, it just seems like we have such a gift with the reporters that we have at this station, especially just right now. There's just an amazing talent in this newsroom right now. And they are out there doing these great stories. And I know, as a reporter who is out there in the field, that it's really kind of can be frustrating because you'll go out and do this really great story, and then you have to make it into a teeny tiny story for air. And so this is an opportunity for them to kind of try doing something a little longer with some of the stories that they really love the best. We've got some really fun stuff happening, and we can take, you know, our listeners out all over Wyoming and beyond, out in the field, and just experience some of these really great stories that these guys are doing.
Yeah, I've seen the lineup, and it looks like we're getting an action-packed season. What are some of the big adventures we'll hear about?
Yeah, so episode one, which actually has already come out this week, so people can go and listen to it right this minute if they wanted, is Hannah Haberman, and she ends up going out. Folks might actually remember when she did this story for Open Spaces. She went out on the anniversary of the day 100 years after Eleanor Davis was the first recorded woman to climb Grand Teton, and went up and climbed this mountain with a group of other women on that anniversary. So yeah, she had this great experience and had to do a story that was only 5 minutes long for Open Spaces, but now she's going to have an opportunity for the Modern West to share the full experience of that. And it was actually a very personal experience for her. So that's another whole aspect of the story that she gets to include in this podcast version. The other thing, we've got Caitlin Tan. She went to Atlantic City, which is on South Pass, and everybody knows that drive. And maybe you haven't stopped over and gone and visited Atlantic City, which is a really cool historic little town. But Caitlin did, and she happened to be on her bicycle when she did it. And she encountered all these other bicyclists and hikers, and she was like, what is going on here? So she did a really great podcast version of that story. And so we get to go to Atlantic City and just wander all around, talking to all the crazy characters that live in Atlantic City. So that's going to be episode two. There's many more. We have many adventures in this season, and so everybody needs to come and join us and tag along on these really cool adventures.
Can you delve into the stories that you're contributing for this season?
Sure. I will be doing an episode about the arrival of wolves. They migrated down from Yellowstone and wandered into Colorado. And as many people know, Colorado is now actually introducing wolves in the state. They just released their first 10. But these wolves actually migrated in naturally, and that was 5 years before this. So those ranchers have actually had 5 years of experience to kind of pass along that information. And I think that there has just been, in the reporting about the arrival of the wolves there, there's been a lot of us versus them. And so what I really wanted to do is go to my own community where I knew a lot of people and show that there's actually a much more nuanced feelings about these wolves. And so that's kind of what I did with that story. And I think it's been really cool to just go out and hear from lots and lots of different points of view. The other story that I am working on is going to be episode 5, and I went to the Wyoming Honor Farm, which is, it's actually a prison where prisoners, and this is a minimum security prison, they're actually, you know, out growing the hay, feeding the hay to the cattle. When I was up there, it was calving season, so they were spending all day, hours and hours, taking care of the mama cows as they were giving birth and like bringing all of these babies into the world. There was baby calves everywhere. Wow. It was adorable. But the other thing, the really cool thing, is that they have these prisoners also training wild horses. They have a collaboration with the BLM, and they are taking horses when they're pretty young, and getting, you know, prisoners who are, you know, really struggling with all sorts of other things that they are dealing with, and feelings of incarceration and being unable to, you know, they're imprisoned and they are unable to leave. And here it is, they're dealing with a wild horse that was wild, and then now it's now imprisoned and dealing with the feeling of like, okay, how do I come to terms with being a tame animal now? And so it's just, the parallels were really interesting. And I got to talk to two prisoners who were very articulate about that, how that has been therapeutic for them to be working with these animals. Boy, they had really bonded with these horses. And so I got to get out into the corrals with them as they were training them. And so I'm really excited to share that story.
Well, it sounds like a very exciting season. When can we start hearing these episodes, and where can we find them?
So the first episode just dropped, and that was Hannah Haberman's episode about climbing Grand Teton. Then episode 2 is coming out in 2 weeks, and so that one will be the one with Caitlin Tan visiting the Atlantic City on South Pass. And every 2 weeks after that, every Wednesday, every other Wednesday, we will be having a new episode. So yeah, enjoy finding those in your feed, wherever it is that you get podcasts. Or if you like, you can also go and find them at wyomingpublicmedia.org. We have a podcast tab. You drop that down, and there we are, Modern West, and click and go.
Amazing. Well, Melody Edwards, host and producer of the Modern West podcast, thank you for being here with me today.
Thanks for having me.
Stay with us. We end the show with our Wyoming Veterans StoryCorps series and a look at one of the bands for the Buffalo Bill Wild West show. This is Open Spaces.
Wyoming Public Media now brings you our daily news roundup, delivered right to your inbox. You'll read interesting stories from just down the street and around the state. Subscribe to our daily roundup at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. Last summer, the nonprofit StoryCorps hosted an oral history project here in Wyoming in which veterans and their families recorded honest and personal stories about their military experiences. We're grateful and excited to share those conversations with our listeners as a monthly series on Open Spaces. This month, we're highlighting Colonel Holly Schoenefeldt and colleague Jackie Marie as they discuss how gender roles during basic training have changed and why she joined the military.
My name is Jackie Marie. I'm 39 years old. Today's date is July 28th, 2022. We're in Cheyenne, Wyoming, and I'm interviewing Colonel Holly Schoenefeldt.
And I'm Colonel Holly Schenefeldt. I'm age 51.
So I wanted to start off with what your current military assignment is.
So my current military assignment is with the Wyoming Military Department, and that includes the Air National Guard and the Army National Guard both. And my title is Chief of the Joint Staff. My first thought about really joining the military, my dad was in the Air National Guard. He worked in the Civil Engineering Squadron. And I'd seen him, he'd gone away from the summers. And of course, that was not the trigger to think about. The military was actually the trigger of wanting to go to college and the fact that my parents had agreed to pay for one semester. But beyond that, I needed to figure out how to fund it myself. So walking through the mall, I ended up in the recruiter's office. And before I knew it, my civilian acquired skill is at the time was a clarinet player. And the active duty, of course, tried to talk me into it, but then the National Guard actually got a hold of me and I ended up joining the Army National Guard, which my dad was in the Air National Guard. And so it was interesting how that happened.
Did you play the clarinet? Did you join the band?
I did. So I joined the 67th Army Band, which is a Wyoming National Guard unit. So luckily there was a Wyoming Army National Guard recruiter in that office at the time. And they just happened to overhear the conversation. And so I really joined playing the clarinet, but I ultimately ended up, I got out about 10 years later as a saxophone player.
Do you still play either the clarinet or the saxophone?
I do not. So I ultimately, kind of an interesting fact about that is I also learned, I didn't just learn the alto saxophone, but I learned soprano saxophone. So I competed in the Miss Wyoming pageant back in the day. And my talent was playing soprano sax, a Kenny G song.
Wow.
So I actually signed the paperwork. I just turned 18. I graduated high school on the 7th of May, and I went to basic training on the 10th of May. To pass the time, they would put us in a truck and drive us out to the forest. This is in Fort Jackson, South Carolina. Drive us out to the forest, and I spent with several other females raking up pine needles and pine cones and separating the pine needles from the pine cones and putting the pine cones in a pile and spreading out the pine needles back over the forest floor.
Wow. How many days did they have you do that?
3 or 4 days while we waited for enough females to arrive.
Were you relieved when they told you that you're actually going to start basic training?
No, I thought, what did I get myself into? Back in the day, the females who had my particular skill, number one, we came in at a higher rank, but we also had a little bit of a difference between a male and a female. So the females were allowed to do, and I did a split option, which means that one summer you would go to basic training. And then if you had a technical school, you would go to the technical school the next summer between classes. Well, for females, there was no technical school.
Oh.
But for males, the males had to go from basic training directly in to be in a band and do skills qualification for 4 months or three. I can't remember the time frame, but at the time, females didn't have to do that, but males did. And so it was very traumatic when I was told I would have to stay because, of course, I was supposed to start college. And in the end, it worked out. But just maybe that was the first sign that the military life has some unique hurdles in it.
Mm. Yeah. Especially for women at that time.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. A different standard is the males had to stay and do certain things and the females got to go home.
I would just assume that's changed now for band members, that the training is the same regardless of gender.
Yeah, I don't know that answer, to be honest, anymore. Yeah.
I'd be shocked, I guess.
I would be shocked if it was not the same today.
Yeah.
Yeah. Equitable.
At the Buffalo Bill Museum in Cody hangs a wall-sized panoramic photo of Wild West show performers. It includes a group of black musicians.
All of these men holding instruments, trombones, trumpets, clarinets, euphoniums.
This is Syriana Lundgren. She studies the musical history of the American West at Harvard. There wasn't much known about the photo known as Satisfied Musical Entertainers or about the photographer Ferris, who toured with the Wild West show for two seasons in the early 1900s. That is, until Lundgren entered at the Buffalo Bill Center of the West last summer. Lundgren recently shared her findings with Wyoming Public Radio's Olivia Wheats.
Tell us about Ferris's Satisfied Musical Entertainers. Who were they and what kind of music did they play?
They were a band. They were a ragtime band. They were 18 players strong, and they played a variety of early American music, which included not only marches that we might associate with folks like John Philip Sousa, but also they played more complicated genres of music, things like blackface minstrelsy, which was oftentimes the only kind of music that white audiences wanted to see black musicians play. But they were also able to showcase some really wonderful music by black composers, including early ragtime.
So if you and your friends would have, at the time, gone to Buffalo Bill's Wild West, I'm just wondering how you would have experienced Ferris's Satisfied Musical Entertainers. At what point in the program would you have been able to hear their music?
The sideshow band, in almost every other type of show, whether it be circus or Wild West, would never get a chance to perform under the big top. But Ferris's Satisfied Musical Entertainers were fighting the color line in Wild West shows, and they performed a 45-minute long concert in the Big Top Arena after the performance of Buffalo Bill's Wild West show was done, as folks were leaving the arena. And we know this because a network of black cultural critics decided to report on it in black newspapers, particularly a man named Sylvester Russell. And this was earliest researched by some folks named Doug Seraph and Lynn Abbott in their book Ragged But Right. And they describe the way Sylvester Russell, who was a black critic for the Indianapolis Freedman, a black newspaper, would follow Ferris's musical entertainers to write reviews of their concerts under the big top of Buffalo Bill's Wild West show. So you would see the musical performance of Ferris's Satisfied Musical Entertainers either in the sideshow tent before Buffalo Bill's big show took place, or after the show was over, as you were getting ready to leave the stands, they would come out and perform a 45-minute long concert just themselves.
When you were looking at the payroll records during your research, you found that there was some disparity between Ferris's group and the Cowboy Band. And the Cowboy Band was a group of all white musicians. They played the Star Spangled Banner at the beginning of the show. They also played music during the acts. I'm wondering what you found out about the pay disparity between the two groups.
Okay, so get this. The Cowboy Band, which had about the same instrumentation as Ferris's musical entertainers, so we're still looking at trombones, trumpets, clarinets, they were paid as individuals $12 to $18 a week, depending on what chair or what position they had in the orchestra, how good of a player they were. So if I'm some random trumpeter in the Cowboy Band, maybe I'm making $14 a week. Here's the rub. If I play for Ferris's Satisfied Entertainers, first of all, the entire group is getting paid monthly. The entire group is getting paid one monthly salary. And when you work that out to be per week, it comes out to $19 a week for the entire ensemble, which again has 18 members and one conductor. So that would, in total, if everything is split evenly, be $1 a week per person.
Wow.
I'm not a complete expert on the way sideshows were paid. They were contractors with the Wild West show as opposed to employees of the Wild West show. But it doesn't escape my notice that this is a drastic pay disparity between an all-white band and an all-black band.
And Syriana, what do you think that tells us about the show itself and also the wider culture at the time?
There were some interesting pay equities in Buffalo Bill's Wild West show, like the fact that Buffalo Bill's Wild West had far more gender pay equity than many other Wild West shows at the time. That's fascinating. But when you look at the way Buffalo Bill's Wild West show treated its black performers, you see that maybe the show wasn't as progressive as when it came to dealing with race as it was when it came to dealing with gender. And that's certainly something that we need to think about as scholars of the American West and as people who love Western history in general.
In the article that you wrote for the museum's magazine, you write that even though Ferris's group only performed for two seasons with Buffalo Bill's Wild West show, that they left a lasting impression on the show's musical landscape. I'm wondering if you can talk about the impact that Ferris's satisfied musical entertainers made on the show's music.
William Sweeney was the director of the all-white cowboy band. And about a year after Ferris's satisfied entertainers ended up leaving Buffalo Bill's Wild West show, William Sweeney would come out with a piece called The Two Bills March, which was heavily, heavily influenced by the ragtime style of composition. Now, I don't have any direct proof for this, but ragtime during the 1910s and the early 20th century was the center of a culture war in America. And it was really considered a music that was by a lot of upper class, upper middle class, and middle class white society disreputable. The fact that William Sweeney would come out with a heavily ragtime influenced composition, I think directly reflects the musical relationship between Ferris's satisfied entertainers and the cowboy band. William Sweeney almost certainly heard Ferris's satisfied entertainers playing their 45-minute long concert at the end of the show every night. There were over 100 stops on the 1910-1911 season tour, of which Ferris's satisfied entertainers were a part of the entire 1910-1911 season, of which there were more than 100 stops. So William Sweeney likely heard their take on ragtime music again and again and again. So I think his composition, The Two Bills March, which was written to honor Pawnee Bill and Buffalo Bill, was certainly influenced musically by the presence of Ferris's satisfied entertainers.
That was Harvard PhD candidate and former Buffalo Bill Center of the West intern Syriana Lundgren speaking with Wyoming Public Radio's Olivia Wheats about Black musicians in Buffalo Bill's Wild West show. Thank you for listening to Open Spaces. The entire show and all the stories you heard here can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. It can also be found wherever you get your podcasts. And we post all our stories on the station's social media platforms. Thanks to Melody Edwards, our audio producer, and Ivy Engel, our social media manager for today's show. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.